Because if it weren't true, they couldn't even formulate that denial. See, I think the same thing applies to the law of non-contradiction. My proof for the law of non-contradiction, which really leads me to Plantinga, is that he is wrong. There is a transcendental proof for the law of non-contradiction, that it is not self-stultifying, as Plantinga argues here. And the heart of his argument is that there are basic beliefs and that the belief in God is a basic belief. Plantinga is saying you don't have to be an evidentialist, you don't have to accept Aquinas and all this stuff we're saying. You can be a Reformed theologian and you can argue that there are basic beliefs. And the heart of his argument is on page 492, the bottom. Now, of course, the classical foundationalist accepts C, P is properly basic for S, if and only if P is self-evident, incorrigible, or evident to the senses for S. A classical foundationalist accepts C and proposes that we do so as well. And either he takes C as basic or he doesn't. If he doesn't, then he then if he is rational in accepting it, he must, by his own claims, have an argument for it from propositions that are properly basic, by arguments from whose correspondence conditional they are properly basic. Then on the bottom of the page, he says, accordingly, classical foundationalist probably takes C as basic. Then according to C itself, if C is properly basic, taken as basic, it must be either self-evident, incorrigible, or evident to the senses for the foundationalist. And clearly it isn't any of these. If the foundationalist takes C as basic, therefore he is self-referentially inconsistent. In order to understand that, we have to take a look at our foundationalist coherentist chart. I gave you a copy of this, didn't I? All along, we have been avoiding the inevitable until we get to this point, because it came up logically at this point, or at least historically. All along, we have been avoiding the fact that the people who think you can prove the existence of God, the people who hold classical apologetics, are foundationalists. The people who don't, most presuppositionalists, are coherentists. They have a different epistemology. So we have to understand that if you're going to come out, if you're going to understand where you are in this question of faith and reason, you have to understand how coherentism relates to it, or how foundationalism, and which one is true. So let's just look at the difference. First of all, a foundationalist in epistemology believes in, there are some first principles. There are some things that are basic, self-evident, undeniable first principles, like the law of non-contradiction or the law of identity. A is A, A is not, non-A, either A or non-A. Where a coherentist does not believe there are any self-evident, undeniable first principles. He believes the system just coheres together, but there are no foundational principles for it. The model. The foundation uses a pyramid model. This Nowley's claim is built on this, but sooner or later you got to get back to this. That's just the foundation, and you can't get any farther than that because that's self-evidently true. The coherentist model is the web model. This is related to this, is related to that, and the whole thing holds together. But it's just there as a web. It doesn't have to be built on anything. The process of justification. How does a foundationalist go about justifying his belief? Well, he takes any given knowledge claim and he keeps reducing it until he gets to first principles, which are irreducible and self-evident. And there he stops, because he's reached bedrock. He's reached the foundation. A coherentist never stops. That is, logically, you can go on forever. You can say, well, now this is true because of this, and this is true because of this. And he goes two or three layers, and for all practical purposes, that's enough. Two or three layers. He gives you a little bit of the web so your view can cohere, but he never carries it out to the ultimate foundation because he doesn't believe there is one. The relation of premises. The foundationalist sees things as vertical dependence. Logical inference. All men are rational. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is rational. That's vertical. Vertical dependence. Conclusion on premises. Premises ultimately self-evident. The coherentist sees things as mutually dependent. This depends on that, this depends on that, that depends on this. They're all mutually dependent, like a web. How do you justify your view? The foundationalist justifies his view by self-evidence, undeniability. He gets back to a principle like the law of non-contradiction. He says, you can't deny it. Go ahead and try and deny it. You just used it. It's self-evident. Yes, all husbands are married men. Well, just look at married men. Look at husbands. They mean the same thing. It's self-evidently true. That's how the foundationalist operates. The coherentist says, take this over here and this over here and see if it's consistent. You don't justify in terms of any basic self-evident principle. Type of certainty you can get. The foundationalist, you can get absolute certainty. You can be absolutely sure of some things because they're built on absolutely true principles that cannot be denied. The coherentist can never know anything for sure. He can never have absolute certainty. It's always relative and corrigible. It could be different. Plato, Aristotle, I could add Augustine, Aquinas, Anselm, Charles Hodge, Warfield Hodge, Machen, all of the classical apologists are all foundationalists. Coherentists like Willard Quine of Harvard, and for that matter, in the religious realm, people like Van Til and most presuppositionalists. Objections. There are two objections that are generally leveled against classical foundationalism. It leads to an infinite regress of grounds for grounds. How do you know this is a first principle? You say, well, how do I know the law of non-contradiction is true? Because it's contradictory to deny it. Well, then you just use the law of non-contradiction to defend the law of non-contradiction. It either leads to an infinite regress or it leads to dogmatism, assertions without justification. You just say, well, it's self-justifying. So either you stop and say it's self-justifying or you use it to prove it. Circular argument. Those are the two typical, and that's the exact one that, that's exactly what Plotinus almost called Plantinga. Plotinus said here, Plantinga said, it's self-referentially defeating because if you take the statement P, see there on page 492, P is properly basic for S if and only if P is self-evident, incorrigible, or evident to the senses for S, that statement, and apply it to itself, is self-defeating because it doesn't meet the very qualifications it sets up in its own statement. So if you destroy classical foundationalism, and notice this is the trick, all presuppositionalists do it, in order to prove the need for presuppositions, you got to destroy certainty in knowledge. Because if there is certainty, if there are first principles, and if you can have proofs for God, then there's no reason to be a presuppositionalist. But because some people think you can have them, then they spend their time proving skepticism first in order that they can teach their own presuppositionalism. And so that's why they tend to agree with Kant and Hume and the skeptics, because they're helpful in proving that you can't prove, so that you have to presuppose. It's a little dialectic going on there. Now the coherentist, on the other hand, the criticisms of his view is it leads to an infinite regress. I mean, how can this be based on this, be based on this, be based on that, and you never get back to the basis? I mean, based on implies a basis for. But there is no basis if you go on an infinite regress. No, it equals no grounds. Their answer is you only need two or three levels. Well, you don't need two or three levels. Let's take the top three levels of those cement blocks there. The top three levels aren't holding themselves up. You got to get back to a foundation that's holding the whole thing up. Top three levels aren't enough. Or take their spider web illustration. It makes a beautiful illustration, except that it proves our point, the foundationalist point. What's holding the web up? The web's either hanging on a tree or a building or something else. There are no webs in midair. And there are no epistemological frameworks in midair. You got to have a foundation for them. And if you try and get a spider web in midair that's not hanging onto anything or it's not built on anything, you'll see very soon. It's cut off from the real world. The problem with coherentists is that a lot of systems internally cohere, but they don't externally correspond. they've cut themselves off from the real world. They're in their own little web, their own little bubble, now to change the illustration. And inside their bubble, everything is beautiful. Everything is harmonious. They don't have the foggiest idea of their little web that they're spinning in there corresponds to the real world. There's no way to correspond it because they can't get out of their system, which only depends on internal coherence. That leaves us with one problem. These arguments, to me, seem to be convincing against coherentism. How do we answer these arguments that leads to an infinite regress of a grounds for a grounds? Very simply, Plantinga sets up the whole thing wrong. He has a false statement of the principle here, and then he wonders why he gets into problems. So I'd like to restate it for you and show you why Plantinga's argument is wrong. If you say something like this, the law of non-contradiction, that something is either true in terms of itself or true in terms of something else. So let's state them one, two, three fashion. Number one, a true statement, every true statement is true either in itself or by reference to something else. It's only two possibilities. Every true statement is true either in itself or by reference to something else. But everything cannot be true by reference to something else. Can't have an infinite regress because you don't have any basis for that statement. So everything cannot be true by reference to something else. Therefore, some things must be true in themselves. Simple little proof for foundationalism. Everything has to be true in terms either of itself or of something else. Everything can't be true by reference to something else, because that would be true in reference to something else and something else. You go into infinite regress, nothing is true. You never get back to the truth. Everything can't depend on something else. Something has to be depended upon. So every true statement is true either in itself or by reference to something else. Everything can't be true by reference to something else. Therefore, something must be true in terms of itself. It's the only logical conclusion. Something must be true in reference to itself. Four, something is true in itself when the predicate is reducible to the subject. Something is true in itself when the predicate is reducible to the subject. Now, in logic, as you know, the subject and predicate means what comes before the is and after the is in the statement. And we're simply saying that all husbands are married men is true in and of itself, simply because when you analyze the predicate, when you analyze our married men, all husbands are in the category of married men. When you analyze the meaning of that, you see that this predicate is saying exactly the same thing as that subject. The predicate is reducible to the subject, so that's self-evidently true. Same thing for this. Every effect has a cause. When you analyze what is meant by effect, it means something that is being caused. If an effect is something that is being caused, then of course every effect has a cause. That's self-evidently true. More obvious is being and other things like that, but something is true in itself when its subject, its predicate is reducible to its subject. Point five, the laws of logic are of this kind. A is not non-A, either A or non-A. The laws of logic are self-evidently true. Look at the predicate and it's saying the same thing as the subject. Therefore, the laws of logic are true in themselves. Therefore, the laws of logic are true in themselves. Now, I defy anyone to show any statement there that is self-referentially self-defeating. See, if you set it up wrong, like Plantinga does, it comes out wrong. If you set it up right, it comes out right. The most likely premise to be attacked is number four. Something is true in itself when its predicate is reducible to its subject. That's the most likely one to be attacked, and yet it's the most lucidly self-evident one. It's not saying any more than A is A. It's not saying any more than a horse is a horse or a triangle is a three-sided figure. And that is not self-referentially defeating. The typical way that it's done is like this. Well, what you did very cleverly there, they would say, if a coherentist were here, he would say, what you did very cleverly was you just used the law of non-contradiction to prove the law of non-contradiction. And so you argued in a circle. My response to that is I did not. I used the law of non-contradiction in the process of proving the law of non-contradiction, but I did not use the law of non-contradiction as the basis for proving the law of non-contradiction. For example, the statement, I can speak a word in English. I just used English in the process of telling you I could speak a word in English. Is that wrong? No, there's nothing wrong with using English to say I can speak a word in English. Now try this one. I can't speak a word in English. Something wrong. What? I used English to tell you I can't speak in English. There's nothing wrong with using English to speak in English. There is something wrong in using English to say you can't use English. Same thing with the law of non-contradiction. There's nothing wrong in using the law of non-contradiction to show you that the law of non-contradiction is valid. There is something wrong with using the law of non-contradiction to tell you that the law of non-contradiction is not valid. Or to put it another way, my proof for the law of non-contradiction is not that it is contradictory to deny it, but that it is impossible to deny it without using it. Try it. Even Van Til, my logic doesn't apply to God. Sounds pious, doesn't it? Sounds like that gives glory to God. Makes me a little puny thing. It makes God big, infinite, sovereign, wonderful. And my logic doesn't apply to God. You just used your logic to talk about God. And you're assuming that statement is true as opposed to false.
My problem, so supposing I would want to argue for a presuppositionalism or even an atheist, whatever it is, if the effect needs a cause, that is a logical law, that's a law of logic, that every effect needs a cause.
No, I'm not saying that only the laws of logic.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I say the laws of logic are of this kind. I want to give you some more. Since you asked for it, there's more than the laws of logic. I would suggest that here are some basic axioms. I'm a foundationalist, and I'm giving you my foundational principles. Now, I'm telling you what I think is sine qua non. These are all reducible to their subject. They're all self-evidently true. Being is being. B is B, law of identity. Non-being is not being. Non-B is not B, law of contradiction. Either being or non-being, B or not B, law of excluded middle. Something, now those are all formal logical principles. The next one isn't. Something exists, B is. Or, for that matter, B is B, except now we're using it existentially, not just formally. Being is being doesn't mean that there is a being. Now I'm saying something is. Now we got something is, and something is what something is. Something is not what something can be. Something is what something is. Non-being cannot cause being. Negative law of causality. Only being can cause being. Positive law of causality. Now I think from that I can prove the existence of God. I got first principles that aren't merely formal. Some apply to the real world. That are all self-evidently true, from which you can prove a necessary and eternal being. Jonathan Edwards did. We just went through it. Non-being can't cause being. If something is, something must always have been. You got eternal, necessary being that must exist.
Couldn't it just say, well, so far we have observed that, you know, that something is caused by something else, and nothing pops out of non-existence. But I believe that something popped out of non-existence.
What he's doing is he's challenging premise
negative
law of causality. Non-being cannot cause being. And what I would show is the predicate is reducible to the subject. He is saying non-being caused being. Cause implies you have something that exists that's doing it. Non-being implies there's something that doesn't exist. He just contradicted himself.
Right. so what did he get out of it? Just like you got out of Heidegger's sentence by saying, well, Kant is not the correct way to say it. I don't know what to say. Personally, I don't know what to say, but couldn't he get out of the use of the word cause and say something else to get out of it?
Go ahead.
For me, from me.
Either being caused it or non-being caused it. You only have two possibilities. Non-being caused it is a contradiction in terms, because non-being and cause are the opposite. Cause bees and non-being doesn't be. I would add another one there. Only being can cause, not only being can cause being, but if a subdivision of this that you almost have to diagram the same way, is that being does cause being. It does not cause, or a kind of a negative one, being does not cause non-being. Being does not cause non-being, and then you have the basis for the principle of analogy. Why? If being can't cause non-being, analogy must be true. Must be an analogy. Why? Yeah, because B has to be similar to B, if not identical. We'll get to a minute why it can't be identical. B has to be similar to B. It's only not B that's different. So the only thing that B can cause is B. If B produces nothing, nothing doesn't have to be similar to it, but you can't produce nothing. You can't bring nothing to be. Nothing is already there. You can only bring something to be. And whatever you bring to be must be similar to the cause. The effect must be similar to the cause because, and this is Aquinas' principle, act communicates act. Act produces act. Being produces being. Now that raises some subsidiary questions here, and that is a necessary being, this also necessarily follows, cannot produce a necessary being. Why? Yeah, because by definition, the predicate is reducible to subject. By definition, if it comes to be, it's not a necessary being. That means that a necessary being can only produce a contingent being. The only kind of being a necessary being can produce is a contingent being. But a contingent being is a being that both bees has act and might not be has potency. Now you've got a being that is pure actuality producing a being that is both actuality and potentiality. That's the only kind of creature, the only kind of creature a creator can make is a creature. Now you have the basis for analogy. That equals analogy, because analogy means similar, act communicates act, and different. All creatures are different from the creator in that they have potency. All creatures are similar to the creator in that they have actuality. I just gave you, in a nutshell, the whole Thomistic metaphysics, which to me is the only adequate way to explain reality and the only adequate way to justify Christianity, analogy, all the things we do believe, to take a transcendental argument. There is a God up there, miracles are possible, the Bible is the revelation of God. The only metaphysics that adequately explains that is this metaphysics right here. No other metaphysics does it. Yeah, the last one, a necessary being can only produce a contingent being. BN can only produce BC, because you can't create another necessary being. If you created, it wasn't necessary. To be necessary, it'd have to necessarily always exist. If it came to be, it didn't necessarily always exist. So you can't create another necessary being. You can't create an uncreated. You can't cause an uncaused. So what does it have? If it's contingent, contingent means it might not be. That means it has the possibility not to be, but it bees. So it is, has actuality, and it could not be, has potentiality. Therefore, it's composed of act and potency, act in potency means it's similar to its cause and it's different from its cause. Similar and different is what analogy means. See, in a pantheistic universe, if pantheism were true, here's what they'd have to show. That a necessary being, well, we'd have to do this, can only produce another necessary being. Well, that's obviously false. The refutation of pantheism is that once you add necessary being can only produce necessary being, a necessary being you got produced here, produced and necessary are a contradiction. You can't produce a necessary being. Therefore, pantheism is inherently wrong, and theism is inherently provable or intelligible. One other comment on Plantinga before I leave it. If you just step back from Plantinga's argument, here's what's wrong with it. He is trying to prove that there are certain things that are properly basic, and by properly basic he means that they're not, there's no foundation like this, but they're not arbitrary. They're not just pulled out of the blue. I want to believe in God, I want to believe in a pumpkin, you know, that thing. He's trying to prove that there are some things that are reasonable, but not necessarily foundational in the classical sense and not arbitrary in a fideistic sense. The only problem is, if his argument worked, you can still ask the question, what reason does he have for placing God in the category of properly basic? If he has a reason for placing God in the category of properly basic, then it's not properly basic, because he's got a reason for it. If he doesn't have a reason for placing God in that category, then it's arbitrary. It's kind of like the fideist dilemma. Give me a reason why you're a fideist. If he gives you a reason, he's not a fideist. If he doesn't give you any reason, then his view is unreasonable. Doesn't have a reason to ground it. Plantinga's answer to that is, well, I opt to give reasons. It doesn't solve the problem. Because are you saying there are good reasons for being a fideist? Or there aren't? If there are, you're not a fideist. If there aren't, you don't have any good reasons for it. Doesn't matter whether you say I opt to do it or not. The question is whether the position has any reasons for it. If it has reasons for it, it's not fideism. If it doesn't have reasons for it, why should I choose that rather than another view?
That's what I think you might be misunderstanding it, between my understanding and planning. Because when you think, for example, if I see someone displaying typical pain behavior, I think it's that he or she is in pain. Again, I don't think displaying behavior as evidence for that behavior. I don't infer that belief from the others I quote. I don't accept it on the basis of other beliefs. Still, my perceiving the pain behavior certainly is the cause of formation justification of that belief.
Yeah.
If I see somebody in a pain behavior, to me that's an evidence. So I'm wondering if I'm misunderstanding Plantinga, because he puts maybe more weight in the use of the word proof or evidence. Because some of the stuff he said about, you know, why we believe in God.
The answer is
like what Calvin's book here.
Mm-hmm.
I believe those things as proofs. You know, I think they're proofs. Whether they just want to fit in another class, you know, those are proofs. But he doesn't apparently attach that much weight to those, you know, Christian arguments for God.
The answer to your question is on page 495 and two key phrases he uses. A foundational connection between his beliefs and his reasons, or he would be a classical foundationalist, which he's rejecting, right? So what is the connection? 495, first full paragraph. Calvin recognizes, at least implicitly, that other sorts of conditions may trigger, keyword. Now go down one paragraph, first line. There are therefore many conditions and circumstances that call forth. See what he does? In order to avoid classical foundationalist, he would have said, based on, he just says, the evidence is there, it's not coercive, it's not persuasive, it's not the basis of it, but on the occasion of presenting this evidence, it may call forth a belief. But the belief isn't really based on the evidence, the belief was just called forth on that occasion, or what's the other phrase, triggered by giving those circumstances, you know. So Habermas might come into a presuppositionalist thing and present all the evidence for the resurrection. It might trigger somebody believing in the deity of Christ, but in no way was that evidence the basis for that belief.
So my disagreement was just a matter of definition of evidence.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you're a coherentist or a foundationalist.
No, I'm a foundationalist, and I say nothing causes, nothing. I mean, something cannot come out of nothing. To me, that is as much evidence and proof for God's existence as
sure.
I want to have. He says, no, that's no evidence. But I say, yes, it is. So.
I do, too. But
that's where he betrays himself.
Yeah, that's right. He betrays himself. He sets up a straw man, self-referential argument for classical foundationalism, which helps to justify the plausibility of your accepting something as properly basic without being, and then he sets up evidence, so you don't believe in the pumpkin theory. He says, well, there's evidence that surrounds this, but the evidence isn't the basis for it. It just may trigger it or call for it. It's really tricky. It's very tricky.
Presuppositionalists would look at this and just put on their own head and would say, you are making this superior to God, therefore you're violating God's sovereignty. Would it be correct to say that you are saying, no, this is a part of God which he has revealed to me?
Yeah. I'm saying he's confusing ontology and epistemology. This is my basic criticism of all presuppositionalism. They, especially this one, they confuse ontology and epistemology. Ontology is the way things are. Epistemology is the way we know that things are. Now, what he is absolutely right ontologically. Ontologically, God is prior to logic. But epistemologically, logic is prior to God. Why? Because I have to start where I am in my understanding of human reason. And if I'm going to understand God is as opposed to God is not, I've got to use the law of non-contradiction, because when I say God is, I surely don't mean he is and he is not. So epistemologically, I begin with logic. But that logic is built on the nature of God. That logic was revealed. It's inherent in his nature. It's inherent in my nature. There is an analogy between me and God. Therefore, we talk the same language. It's not is and is not, totally different. And the whole incarnation of Christ, the whole created world, the doctrine of creation, the doctrine of incarnation, to me is the proof of that. And so I start with, ontologically, God is prior to everything else. Epistemologically, logic is prior, so I can even know God. But when I come to know him, I come to know that he's the very basis for the laws of logic by which I knew him.
I follow and agree with all that you're saying, except for the concept you're saying that ontologically God is prior to logic, and then later on you said logic is a part of the character of God.
Yeah.
So I was hearing you right. Then how
both of those are true.
Okay.
He's not prior to logic in the sense of logic being a reflection of his rational nature, because he'd be prior to his own nature. But he's prior to logic as a revealed science or philosophy, which we state in terms of these three laws.
Okay, in the same sense that I can say that God is love. I'm not trying to...
Exactly, same
sense.
Can
I say God is logic?
That's exactly right. And Gordon Clark, bless his rationalistic heart, translated John 1:1, in the beginning was logic, and logic was with God, and logic was God. And as repugnant as that may sound, and certainly not all the truth of that verse, it's certainly implied in that verse.
Can a presuppositionalist say,
is this Samuel Beckett's play? He had a play like that.
No, can he say, again, back to the question, how do you know your mind is not messed up? How do you know that all this stuff sounds good to you? It's all in your mind. Things spin, and I cannot refute it by using the same lingo. Nevertheless, it has no application to reality. There is no certainty that this applies to reality. I'm not even sure if I'm formulating it.
It's a self-defeating statement.
I'm saying it because the guy says, well, I am, I cannot say any other language. I mean, I've got to use this to communicate, but there's no basis for your logic because you might be messed up and you don't know it.
Well, but that is a self-referential statement. It's not simply that he isn't using it. He's saying it cannot be any other way. And once you say cannot be, or once you say only, this is only, then you are going beyond the system. So he's using it's like saying my logic doesn't apply to God. Once you try and limit your logic here, but then transcend it in the very statement to be talking about God, you have used your logic to go beyond God to say that your logic doesn't reach to God. It's self-defeating. And that's the proof of foundation. If you ask me, why are those principles true? I'd say, first of all, they're self-evident. You say, well, but that's just using the principle to prove the principle. I'd say, well, you can use it in the process, but it's not the basis. My proof is that they're undeniable. You can't deny them. So undeniability is the basis for accepting them, whereas the principle is used in the process of showing their undeniability. The principle isn't the basis for denying them. And that's really what Schaeffer is saying. If you look at, now let's take a look at all the presuppositionalists except Van Til. And we keep saying presuppositionalism is so, and I see what I did with my chalk. I can't find the crazy chalk. Here it is. All the presuppositionalists except Van Til, we've got Carnell. He was probably one of the greatest of them. We have Clark. We have Schaeffer. And Van Til. But you can put a Kantian Gulf right here. You've got all the other three presuppositions strongly emphasize reason and the principle of logic. That all the Schaeffer, that his whole upper story, lower story thing, that's what he was getting at. You know, you can't make that bifurcation. It depends on the wrong people, can't take on. And Kierkegaard, but he was absolutely right. Clark, the law of non-contradiction is the whole basis of the system. Only Christianity is non-contradictory. All other systems are contradictory. There are only a finite number of systems. If you only have five systems and four of them are contradictory and one is non-contradictory, it must be true. That's Clark. And then, in a nutshell, Carnell has a transcendental argument for the principle of non-contradiction. Says it's transcendentally necessary to presuppose this thing in all of our thinking and everything. So don't think of the presuppositionalist as irrationalists. Van Til comes the closest to being one. These guys were all strong proponents of the law of non-contradiction and the basic laws of logic. They just used them in a little different ways. Clark thought it could do the whole thing. Carnell thought it could only do part of it. Your system has to be non-contradictory, it has to be comprehensive, and it has to be existentially adequate. So he has really three tests for truth. If it's non-contradictory, it explains all the facts, and if it's existentially relevant to your life, it's true. And so that's called systematic coherence as a test for truth, and that would be Gordon Lewis of Denver Seminary. He's a disciple of Carnell. He keeps his view alive. His book has been reprinted in University American Library. Clark used just the law of non-contradiction, and I must say, Schaeffer is a little harder to pin down. I think Schaeffer uses the law of non-contradiction, and then he uses unlivability, the fact that no unbeliever can live this. So I think unlivability, as well as non-contradiction, will become the test for truth in his system, and whether he has another one is a debate among Schaeferians and critics of Schaeffer, but he surely is saying you can't live this non-Christian view. You've got to, if it weren't for God, you couldn't even live this way.
Would it be fair to say with somebody like Schaeffer that they almost start presuppositionalist from a practical viewpoint because he was speaking to the masses or people? Because if you try to prove everything, I mean, your book gets so long, nobody's going to read it.
Schaeffer, my answer is yes, and here's why. Schaeffer was not a philosopher, he was not a theologian, he was not an apologist. He was an evangelist. He was an evangelist to intellectuals. And that's why his method really comes out of his mission. His mission is to evangelize. He was evangelized people who were totally different worldview. He devised a system that worked in doing that, take them where they are, show them where that leads. You can't live this. Show them how this will lead here, and you can live this, and try and get them converted.
Essentially, your foundation would essentially be no different than Schaeffer's presupposition. It's just that you have demonstrated that you can prove your foundation, and Schaeffer is just taking this as my starting point. Am I oversimplifying?
No, that's exactly right. In fact, I'll even strengthen it. Schaeffer has a transcendental argument. Schaeffer says it is transcendentally necessary to postulate this in order to account for that. His mountain valley illustration of the water filling up, that's not going to fill up the other valley higher, is really a transcendental argument.
So what would be your critique of Schaeffer?
Didn't go far enough. Now, let me add mine to the... I mean, you could call my view a presuppositionalism. I'd be glad to put my name right down there with those top three and just add one more thing.
my test for truth is not that it is unlivable, but that it's undeniable. I use undeniability as the test for truth. Schaefer uses unlivability. I think his is too weak. I think his turns out to be kind of pragmatic. You know, unlivable for whom? You know, maybe a Buddhist can live as Buddhism, maybe a Hindu can live as Hinduism, you know, maybe. But I'm saying, he's saying that the unbeliever can't live his falsehood. I'm saying the unbeliever can't even state his falsehood. If he states it, it's going to fly back in his face. If he throws out like a boomerang, it'll come back in on the back of the head. Because the unbeliever starts to state things like, nothing exists, he has to exist. Everything is relative, he has to have an absolute standpoint to say that. All is in progress. How do you know if you're in progress too, whether all is in progress? Everything the unbeliever states boomerangs back on himself. His view is literally undeniable. So I think going stronger.
That question would keep you, sir.
But would not Schaefer, though, say, of course we know Schaefer's right at this point, but would he not say that his is more appealing? I mean, it's not at this point
it's more existentially appealing. So whatever is existentially appealing.
No, I'm not trying to judge. I think it goes back once again to the purpose of what you are doing, the two of you are doing, at least that.
I don't say that isn't a good technique for evangelism.
Yeah.
I just say that's not an adequate apologetic.
Yeah.
I think it's a very good technique for evangelism. But sooner or later, you're going to run into perfectly content Buddhists and Hindus who are perfectly consistent,
right,
who say, this is living very well for me.
Right. Yeah. why do you put yourself here with this presupposition?
I'm just saying, I don't mind, because they have transcendental arguments. They
okay.
have they are foundationalists. They have
okay.
foundation. They have
so
first
you
principles.
So you would put them in your foundationalist list,
yeah,
rather than put yourself in their list. Okay.
It's the coherentist I don't like. It's the coherentist that I think are cobwebs hanging in the middle of the air. You can't get to truth that way. I see that hand as the evangelist said, flying into New York.
The propositionality of somebody's foundational wisdom on itself is one that's not arbitrary.
It is. It's a form of foundationalism, but it's a form of foundationalism without a foundation. Plantinga sees his view as a foundationalist. In fact, a lot of my friends, this was about 10 years ago, but we spoke at ETS one time, and I was arguing with my colleague at that time, Feinberg, with whom we wrote an Introduction to Philosophy book, and we didn't know when we started to write this book that he was a coherentist and I was a foundationalist. So when we got to that chapter, obviously we didn't agree, so we just kind of let it hang there. You know, here's the arguments for one, here's the arguments for the other. That's all you can do when you co-author a book. And I said to Paul Feinberg, I said, Plantinga is a foundationalist. Yeah, I said, oh no, he's not. Plantinga is a presuppositionalist atheist. I said, let's ask him. So he gave his address at ETS and he's all through. I said, would you call yourself a foundationalist? He said, yes, I'm a foundationalist. I just distinguish myself from classical foundationalism, which he does in the article. I don't know what you call this, neoclassical or anti-classical, but classical foundationalists believe there are self-evident first principles which are undeniable. Plantinga doesn't believe there are self-evident principles which are undeniable, but he does think it's justifiable to think of some things as properly basic, that you can never ask the question, why do you believe this? Why do you believe in God? There's certain things that triggered me doing. You know what he answered? You don't think he's a hyper-Calvinist that's still in his blood. When he was in Dallas, we had that theist-atheist conference a number of years ago, and Plantinga was known, he was already quoted in Time magazine at that time, and he was a nationally known philosopher. The media was there, and the media wanted to interview him. They knew who he was. And they said, why do you suppose, and the point of the meeting was that, you know, there's kind of revival and belief in God among philosophers. The last three presidents of the APA were all Christians, evangelical Christians. And they asked Plantinga, how do you account for this revival and interest in the existence of God among philosophers? And he said,